Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Remember the hole in the ozone layer? It's closing.
When governments and scientists and corporations really work together to solve a problem, it can be solved.
I'm Marco Werman. Today on the show, an environmental success story and the struggle to replicate it. Also, we remember Iran's political uprising and its musical voice of protest.
Iranians are avid music listeners, and so it's basically impossible to silence.
And in Turkey, leaders of the opposition have literally been shouting about the sad state of democracy there.
Demokrasiye, cumhuriyete sahip çıkmak için.
And one country taking part in Russia's song contest is kind of a shocker. Hint, it's the U.S. All of that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here this Friday. President Trump has spent the week in the UK, but it's another spot on the map that came into sharp focus yesterday when Trump expressed interest in restoring a U.S. presence in Afghanistan by reclaiming the Bagram Air Base. Trump made note of the base's location.
One of the reasons we want the base is, as you know, it's an hour away from where China makes its nuclear weapons.
That's a detail we'll revisit. We start today's show with the strategic value of Bagram Air Base. For that, we're joined by Dennis Wilder. He's been a top expert on China for the CIA and the U.S. National Security Council.
There are a number of reasons. Trump has named one, although he's incorrect on a detail. The actual facility he's talking about is the Lop Nor nuclear test site of the Chinese, which has been in Xinjiang Autonomous Region since 1964. They don't manufacture nuclear weapons there. Those are done in central China. But he's right that it is an hour by jet fighter between Bagram and the nuclear test site. I think if you ask DOD and they gave a candid response, actually the reason to go back to Bagram is much more about anti-terrorism right now than about China. A base in Bagram to monitor and attack terrorists would be extremely useful to the United States. In the longer term, having a base in Bagram is strategically useful. It opens up in a U.S.-China conflict, a second front, if you will, away from the Pacific. And the Chinese would have to plan for contingencies in the West, even if the United States didn't actually attack into China.
Strategically, in your opinion, Dennis, does that make sense in terms of keeping a check on China?
I think it is a useful hindrance. I wouldn't say it is a dramatic thing because the Chinese would be very skeptical that we would attack China directly in a, for example, a Taiwan Strait crisis. In most war games I've played with the Pentagon, we don't want to do that because the escalatory risk is too high. However, you could, from Bagram, for example, launch surveillance drones into China during a contingency. So there is a utility. I would not say it was high.
What do you think is in it for the Taliban if this were to be negotiated?
If I were the Taliban, I would want from the United States a huge amount of economic assistance. As you know, Afghanistan is a very underdeveloped nation. They need a lot of help. And so the price would be very high. I am not sure, though, that the U.S. Congress or the American people would be willing to give the kind of assistance necessary to a radical leadership like the Taliban.
What kind of turnaround would that represent for U.S.-Afghan relations? And what are the risks?
It would be a 100% turnaround. Now, I will mention another idea. The Afghans could offer something much more small, low scale, perhaps even clandestine. A drone base somewhere in Afghanistan could be possible and would be very hard to detect.
we should remember that this was a public statement, cameras and microphones on. So I wonder what counteroffer the Chinese might be putting out there to keep the U.S. away. I mean, they've already been making inroads with the Taliban since the U.S. withdrawal, right?
Chinese exports to Afghanistan are skyrocketing. $541 million in exports in just the first 7 months of the year. Also, Chinese mining companies and Chinese oil extraction firms have moved into Afghanistan. Also, remember that China does not want Afghanistan supporting Uyghur separatists in the country.
Yeah, I mean, Uyghurs, the ethnic minority in Western China, which China has heavily suppressed.
They have, over the years, been very concerned about Uyghurs leaving Western China and setting up bases in Afghanistan. And indeed, when the United States went into Afghanistan, they did find there were Uyghur terrorists embedded with Osama bin Laden.
So is Kabul already doing fine with China without some offer from the U.S. for Bagram?
They're doing better. The Chinese want to make them part of the Belt and Road Initiative. Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, was just in Afghanistan to discuss these kinds of issues. Yes, I think from Afghanistan's point of view, China is a very good option because China does not interfere in human rights issues in Afghanistan, doesn't demand things of them. It just wants to trade.
In 2020, Trump's last year of his first term, there was a peace agreement that was signed by his administration and the Taliban in Doha. That was before the chaotic departure from Afghanistan under Biden a year and a half later. Diplomatically now, though, what kind of capital does the Trump White House actually have with the Taliban?
Very little at this point. Of course, the Taliban has gone back to some of the traditional ways, the very strict Islamic ways. Young women are not allowed into schools these days again, and universities. And there are other very strict Islamic laws being implemented. That makes it very difficult for the United States to foster a relationship with the Taliban. So the kind of government in Kabul has really kept Washington from doing very much there.
So, Dennis, you started by saying that the U.S. reclaiming Bagram Air Base could have some benefits. I mean, is it a realistic idea, though?
I don't think so, again, unless the United States was really willing to pour aid into Afghanistan and dramatically improve the diplomatic relationship. I think this is like Greenland, one of Trump's dreams, but not a very realistic one.
That's Dennis Wilder. He's currently a fellow at Georgetown University. Democracy is in peril in countries across the globe. Turkey is one case. Many are worried that President Recep Tayyip Erdogan may be turning off the lights on democracy. That's what the opposition party CHP clearly maintains, with 16 of the party's mayors now in jail, not to mention a court case on the horizon that could replace party leadership with court-appointed trustees. Dorian Jones of Deutsche Welle reports from Turkey on where things stand in the country now.
Genel Başkanımız Özgür Özel'i davet ediyorum.
In Ankara on Saturday, over 100,000 turned out in support of the Republican People's Party, the CHP.
Demokrasiye, cumhuriyete sahip çıkmak için.
Özgür Özel, the CHP leader, bellowed that his party is fighting for the very future of Turkish democracy. Özel's voice, as always, sounds a little hoarse. Ever since the March arrest of Istanbul's mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu, which started a legal assault on the CHP, Özel has been crisscrossing the country addressing huge rallies twice a week. Those attending the Ankara rally are heeding Özel's message. This woman, who didn't want to give her name out of fear of retaliation, says, "I'm here for my children's future. I'm here for my grandchild's future. And of course, I'm here for my future. And I support the CHP party to the end." While this retiree also didn't want to give his name, said it's about justice.
Dolmamızın nedenlerinden ülkemizde maalesef ne adalet.
He said the reasons for us being here are that sadly there is no justice, law or value for humans in general. Everyone is selling our motherland parcel by parcel. The added urgency of the Ankara rally is now the prosecutors are targeting Özel, alleging voter irregularities at a congress 2 years ago. If found guilty, the court can remove the CHP leader and the rest of his party leadership, appointing trustees in their place. Political analyst Atilla Yeşilada of Global Source Partners warns that with CHP challengers enjoying double-digit leads in opinion polls, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is determined to quash them.
I called it CHP versus Goliath. They're really fighting against impossible odds. We're seeing things that show me Erdogan really doesn't have any limits anymore. We're talking about a country where the president is the state and the judiciary and the police and the army. At the end, I'm afraid he's going to get what he wants. And CHP, as we know it, as an opposition force, will disappear or paralyze for a long period of time.
On Wednesday, the CHP saw another of its local mayors in Istanbul jailed. That makes 16 mayors and over 300 other CHP officials arrested since a crackdown started. İlham Özgel, the CHP's foreign affairs coordinator, admits they are struggling against the legal onslaught.
Oh yeah, we are under multi-frontal attack from all directions at almost every level. You know, running from one court case to another. 16 of our mayors are in prison right now, and they threaten our mayors. So they approach our mayors. So there are two options: you either join our party or you face jail term. Some of them refuse such an offer, and they accept to be put into jail, and some of them choose to join the government party.
Beykoz Belediye Başkan Vekilimiz Özlem Vural Gürsel.
Earlier this month, Erdogan at a party rally broadcast live on TV welcomed the latest CHP mayor to join his party. Nearly a dozen have broken ranks. Erdogan strongly denies that any duress is involved in the defections and insists the judiciary is independent. Even though, since he came to power more than 20 years ago, not a single mayor of his party has been jailed on graft charges. But analyst Yeşilada warns Erdogan, while appearing to be omnipotent, could be taking the biggest gamble of his career.
You look at recent polls, the first complaint of the public remains economic conditions, but justice rose to number two. Is not something that only relates to CHP. It also decreases people's confidence in the system and their propensity to invest into the country. These things don't escape notice. That's what I mean when I say Erdogan took a huge political risk with his career. And it's quite possible that at some point Bahçeli will say enough is enough. You are destroying the country and may also end the coalition.
Deniz Bahçeli is the leader of the National Action Party and has been Erdogan's political partner ever since Turkey became a presidential system in 2018. Erdogan needs the support of his deputies in order to push through constitutional reform, necessary if he is to seek re-election. Bahçeli has voiced concerns over the crackdown on CHP, which has been courting him. But with the court due to make its decision on the future of the CHP next month, Özgel of the CHP says they are preparing for one last stand.
The only thing that we can do, we rely on our people, our electorate, or our democratic forces in the country. And we're not going to leave the general headquarters where I'm sitting right now. And we're not going to give it up. So we're going to continue with our political rallies. And we were going to take the streets probably. So it's not an easy win for the government. We're going to fight everywhere, at every level.
The CHP is vowing to organize further rallies in the run-up to next month's court decision on the party's future. Additional arrests of mayors are also expected as the legal noose tightens around the opposition, with Erdogan warning no one is above the law.
That's Dorian Jones of Deutsche Welle. Coming up, a hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica once posed a threat to life on Earth. That has changed for the better. Stay tuned to find out why. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Mike Troy, host of the American Revolution podcast on the Airwave Media Network. This podcast is the origin story of the United States, how we went from colonies ruled by a king to the democratic republic that we have today. The American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end. Please subscribe for free. We're available on all major podcast platforms. I hope you will join me today on the American Revolution podcast.
A BetterHelp ad. Louis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
Or I struggle most weeks to like get up, get myself up and ready and go to therapy or, you know, whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Because like, I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The giant hole in the ozone above Antarctica is not so giant anymore. New data from the World Meteorological Organization finds that not only have global efforts to heal the ozone layer over nearly four decades basically worked, but they are still working. In fact, within the next couple of decades, a hole is expected to close completely. It's all because of an international agreement known as the Montreal Protocol, ratified by 20 countries in 1987. It went into effect in 1989. It's a success story that doesn't get told enough, so we're going to do that now with Pamela Chasek. She's a professor of political science at Manhattan University.
The ozone layer is a thin layer around the entire planet. It's a slightly bluish gas. What it does is absorbs the most dangerous ultraviolet B radiation in the stratosphere and prevents that from reaching the Earth's surface. Exposure to this radiation can cause skin cancer, cataracts, weakened immune systems in humans, and it can damage aquatic food chains, cause direct damage to crustaceans and fish eggs, threatening fisheries and other aquatic resources. Also, a 10% reduction in the ozone layer could reduce plant production, reducing global crop production. So it threatens plants, animals, and humans, and microbes.
And then it was found that like spraying deodorant on your body was problematic for this. Why?
Because it used, so chlorofluorocarbons were created in the 1920s, and they were very versatile. And so they were used as coolants in air conditioning and refrigeration systems, propellants in aerosol sprays, solvents in cleaning electronic components. They were used in, as a blowing agent in the manufacture of foam. So you may remember, older people may remember when McDonald's had sort of these foam containers for its sandwiches, right, which were phased out because they were made with chlorofluorocarbons. And CFCs are not the only gas that affects the ozone layer today. The Montreal Protocol controls a number of gases that have all been subsequently found to deplete the ozone.
So, Pam, what exactly did the Montreal Protocol do to protect and start healing the ozone layer?
Initially, when it was adopted in 1987, the negotiators agreed that they would call for initially a 50% decrease in the production and consumption of these chemicals, and that developing country parties would have, you know, 10 years more to be able to deplete this. But as soon as the hole in the ozone layer was discovered, right after this treaty was adopted, immediately they started strengthening it. And why it has been so successful, one, the science. This whole treaty follows the science, which is irrefutable. To this day, no decision is made by this treaty without scientific evidence. Second, every country is a party to it, universal. Third, these are all man-made chemicals, and it's much easier to control man-made chemicals than something like carbon dioxide, which, you know, it's everywhere. And so we can, through technology, we can develop those replacements, which makes it you know, putting all together, the technology, the science, and the universal support makes for a successful treaty.
Can you explain the more recent finding about the expectation that the hole in the ozone layer will close up all the way?
That's actually very, very exciting. And, you know, because it shows, you know, this has long been considered the most successful environmental treaty that there is. And the WMO report that was issued this week actually shows that, you know, it is on track to recovery. And it shows in this case that, you know, when governments and scientists and corporations and others really work together to solve a problem, it can be solved. And, you know, why is it successful? Because we've phased out most of the chemicals that have contributed to the problem.
Why hasn't the world been able to kind of replicate this success on other agreements, do you think?
It depends on the nature of the agreement. In this case, because you have specific chemicals that you can focus on, and we have the knowledge and technology to start to develop other chemicals that can be used as coolants, for example, in refrigerators and air conditioners. At the same time, other treaties, you know, take, for example, the Paris Agreement on climate change and the whole climate regime. One of the biggest challenges is because this deals with energy. And while we have found substitutes for, you know, fossil fuels that contribute the most to climate change, until recently, they have not been cost effective. Now they are. We still haven't developed the technology around them to be used in every single application. And it affects major economic interests throughout the world. While ozone depleting chemicals did represent an economic interest, it's not nearly to the scale of energy.
Pam, can you imagine if there had been ozone denialists in the 70s and 80s? Do you think we would have seen this level of success? There were.
So going back,
how did those voices get kind of overpowered?
I'm going to date myself, but when the Reagan administration and others were assured that this was not going to be an economic drain on the United States to take action, largely because DuPont and Dow Chemical, if I remember correctly, were the two main manufacturers of chlorofluorocarbons. And they saw the writing on the wall and already started developing replacements. And so when U.S. economic interests saw that if we were the first country to have replacements, well, everyone's going to come to us. So, you know, this was, you know, the economics, you can't underplay the role of economics here. And the U.S. has continued to be among the leaders ever since.
Do you worry, though, that the aggressive actions counter to the environment by the current administration and distancing itself from global partnerships could reverse the progress of the Montreal Protocol?
Absolutely. We have to bear that in mind. One of the main things that is important is looking at this as a chemicals convention, even though it is also a climate convention, because CFCs and HFCs and all of these are also greenhouse gases. So by phasing out these chemicals, the Montreal Protocol has made a huge contribution, but it's also categorized as a chemicals convention. And so it's very possible each meeting, each environmental meeting this year, there's been a question of whether the U.S. will field a delegation and who will be there, if anyone, and what they will say. And that is a huge fear. The other issue is the U.S. may be there, but are they going to continue to pay their assessed dues to each convention that allow the treaties to operate? And that has many people really fearing what will be the U.S. participation going forward.
Pamela Chasek is with Manhattan University's Department of Political Science. Still to come on the show, the U.S. has been using military force in what it claims is a fight against drug cartels. Up next, what international law has to say about that. You're with The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The world is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, the World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Venezuela carried out 3 days of military exercises this week. President Nicolas Maduro, who's also the commander-in-chief of Venezuela's armed forces, said the exercises were in response to U.S. military activity in the southern Caribbean. The U.S. has struck at least two boats off the coast of Venezuela, killing more than a dozen people. As The World's Matthew Bell reports, international law experts say the strikes could have serious consequences.
On Tuesday, Vice President J.D. Vance joked about the effectiveness of U.S. military strikes off the coast of Venezuela. During a speech in Michigan, Vance said he recalled a recent conversation he had with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth.
We don't see any of these drug boats coming into our country. They've completely stopped. And I said, I know why. I would stop, too. Hell, I wouldn't go fishing right now in that area of the world. But that is what a military that is dedicated to its purpose and a commander-in-chief that is dedicated to the national good can do.
President Trump has talked about ordering 3 strikes against drug boats this month that killed a total of 14 people. He posted videos of 2 of them on social media and described the alleged drug traffickers as narco-terrorists. This week, Trump suggested that he could order military action against drug cartels on land as well. He did not specify where that might happen, but a story in today's Washington Post says that officials from the Drug Enforcement Agency were calling for military strikes in Mexico early this year. Michael Schmidt is a professor of international law at the University of Reading in the UK. He's also a former military judge in the U.S. Air Force. Schmidt says what's new about these attacks on suspected drug boats is the threshold at which the U.S. is deciding to use deadly force.
So my problem is that we are a country committed to the rule of international law. We have long been such. We've been a leader in international law for many decades, and we're conducting operations that simply aren't in compliance with international law.
Schmidt says that drug traffickers pose a threat to the United States, and of course, something must be done about it. But he says the legal reasoning from the Trump administration for these strikes simply doesn't hold up.
So I've heard the justification is that we are defending ourselves, and the law of self-defense is a very granular, very detailed body of law, and these facts don't fit that justification. And even if they did, the decision to employ lethal force instead of non-lethal or less lethal force would itself have meant that the act of self-defense was unlawful.
Supporters of the administration's policy point out that these are violent, organized criminal gangs trafficking drugs into this country that are killing huge numbers of Americans. So why can't President Trump order the military to use deadly force against them the same way previous presidents went after al-Qaeda? Rebecca Ingber is a law professor at Cardozo School of Law.
I think it's really important to distinguish what's happening here, that we have not suffered an armed attack like we did on 9/11. There is no ongoing armed conflict with an organized armed group such as Al-Qaeda that is engaged in prolonged active military hostilities against us, as was the case between the United States and Al-Qaeda. And so there is absolutely no legal justification here, with or without a congressional authorization. There's no legal justification here for these strikes.
Brian Finnegan is an expert on the laws of conflict with the International Crisis Group. He says it's clear that Latin American drug cartels pose a serious threat to Americans, but military action, he says, is not the solution to the problem.
It makes no more sense to try to bomb our way to victory in the war on drugs than it makes sense to do drone strikes on McDonald's because of cardiovascular disease.
When U.S. officials talk about using military force in Mexico to go after the cartels, Finnegan says that might be part of a saber-rattling tactic to put pressure on the Mexican government to do more against organized crime. But he says American presidents do not have a license to kill outside of the law.
Despite the fact that the Trump administration has, the very first time, designated a number of Latin American criminal entities as foreign terrorist organizations, that doesn't actually make them terrorists in the same way that Al-Qaeda or ISIS were terrorists. And certainly these entities don't appear to be organized armed groups such that the United States could be in an armed conflict with them. The U.S. government is using military tools to attack alleged drug smugglers. That is a misuse of that tool.
Finnegan says he spent many years advising the U.S. government on lethal use of military force. And what's happening now with these strikes in the Western Hemisphere is something new and very dangerous. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
3 years ago this week in Iran, a young woman by the name of Mahsa Amini was arrested and beaten to death in the custody of the Islamic Republic's morality police. Her crime? Wearing a, quote, improper hijab. The death of 22-year-old Amini sparked huge protests and galvanized a passionate movement across the globe under a simple slogan, woman, life, freedom. Today we're looking back at one piece of that movement, the music that came out of it. Nahid Siamdus teaches media and Middle Eastern studies at the University of Texas, Austin. She spoke with The World's Carolyn Beeler about the impact of protest songs that carried Iranian voices around the globe in 2022.
Nahid, the music of Iran's Woman, Life, Freedom movement is so varied and so diverse. I want to start by hearing a bit of perhaps the most famous song tied to the protests, Sharvin Hajapour's song, Baroye.
This song happened pretty soon after the uprising, and what made it really the song that spoke for so many about this movement is that its compilation was very much sort of a democratic process. Sharvin Hajipour, the young musician, the song's meaning is for the sake of, and so, you know, what this movement is for. And he chose those from a hashtag actually called hashtag Baroye, where, you know, thousands of Iranians went on Twitter to write about what they cared about for this movement. And so he collected those and compiled them into this song. And part of the lyrics are, you know, for dancing in the streets, for a simple smile, for the environment, for endangered species, for all these things that Iranians had come out into the streets to protest the government.
So the lyrics actually come from user comments online of what they were protesting for. Very kind of democratic songwriting process there, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Another song that was really influential during these protests was a collaboration between two Iranian rappers, Tumaj Salehi and another known as Justina. Let's hear that. Can't help but move to that beat. What do you hear in this song? Why was it so important to this protest movement?
Tumaj Salehi generally was probably the most prominent musician for this movement. He had a song about a year before the movement called Surah Mush, Rat Hole, where he, you know, warned the Islamic Republic and its officials and all of its apologists to find rat holes and hide because, you know, this movement was coming for them. And so in many ways, his rap was prophetic. And this song, even, Shallagh, which means whip, you know, he'd produced it about a couple months before the movement. But in the song, they're talking about women taking off their headscarves and Justina, who's a rapper who ultimately had to leave Iran because of the power and force of her, you know, feminist lyrics. She sings along with him. And they're, again, warning the Islamic Republic that this time it won't be. There was a phrase during, you know, leading up to the revolution and afterwards, which said when they imposed the hijab 40 some years ago, saying either you put on the headscarf or you get a, you know, smack on the head. And so they turn that around to say to the clerics, you know, it's this time, it's my hair that's going to smack you in the face. So this song also, again, became very representative of this movement.
So when these protests began 3 years ago, Iranian authorities cracked down on protesters. Estimates suggest authorities killed at least 500 people and arrested more than 20,000. But this music was not silenced. How do you explain that?
The Iranian authorities have had a very difficult time shutting down social media. Social media has appended the kind of control they had over this space prior to, say, let's say, you know, the mid-2000s. And Iranians have been very, very prolific at producing music, and it's completely out of their control because there's satellite TV stations that pick up this music on the internet that is produced inside of Iran and elsewhere and boomerang them back into Iranian households. And, you know, Iranians are avid music listeners and producers. And so it's basically impossible to silence.
So the last song we heard predated this protest movement, but I want to play one that had its origins in 2022, Mehdi Yarahi's Rosarito, which means your headscarf. So tell me about the lyrics of this song.
So this song is very explicit. It just says, take off your headscarf. And in the music video, and, you know, Mehdi Yarahi is inside of Iran. He's produced this music video inside of Iran again. You know, in the music video, we see these women dancing and taking off their headscarves. And he says, you know, put your beautiful fragrance into the air by taking off your headscarf. It really changes the scene. It brings so much goodness. You know, it's very explicit. And he, like some of these other musicians that we've discussed, like Tumash Salehi and Shervin Hajipour, was imprisoned for having produced this song and kept for nearly a year after he was released. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
So a lot of these musicians are paying the price with crackdowns in prison time.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. Some of them more than others. Tumash Salehi, the rapper, was tortured badly, and his was probably the most severe imprisonment. But yes, they do end up paying the price.
So let's talk now about Iranian singer Parastu Ahmadi. In December of 2024, Ahmadi held a live-streamed concert where she performed this song. Really a lot of feeling in her vocals there. The name of the song translates to From the Blood of the Youth of the Nation. That's a bold name.
Mm-hmm. This is a song every Iranian knows. It's more than a century, you know, old, from Arif Qazvini at the time of the first constitutional revolution Iranians had, and then became very popular again leading up to the 1979 revolution and throughout uprisings in post-revolutionary Iran. And now this was a real event when Parastu Ahmadi live-streamed this concert, because the woman's voice, solo voice, is still not permitted in the Islamic Republic. And, you know, she produced this concert at a time when Parliament was discussing really severe hijab laws, and the president, you know, Pezeshkian, was actually active against those laws. And in the end, those laws didn't go into action. But at this, you know, very moment when the politicians were discussing clamping down even harder, Parastu Ahmadi released this concert that went viral, singing all these songs, many of them spanning a century-long freedom movement in Iran. And, you know, the lyrics speak about tulips sort of sprouting from all the blood that Iran's youth have had to spill in order to gain these freedoms.
And she was not wearing the hijab in this live stream, correct?
No, as a matter of fact, she was also wearing a somewhat revealing, you know, dress. She was as she would want to be, you know, imagining this other world where you could be a woman and sing as you wish and intone this other world that Iranians could inhabit.
I'm wondering, 3 years on, what strikes you about the role that music has played in this particular movement? What do you think it accomplished? Or is still accomplishing?
I think it really helped bring about sentiments around this protest movement, but also unite Iranians in this endeavor to have a free Iran, have an Iran that is prosperous and has opportunities for its youth. And that's why these older songs keep playing a role, because these are intergenerational songs. Some of them are very new, but some of them are also intergenerational. And so Iranians really bond together around these songs. And music became very much part of the fabric of protests and part of these demands. And the way we see that today is, you know, very recently, in September of 2025, we've seen the Islamic Republic allow for concerts that we've never seen in Iran before, very much sort of out in the public, still no women solo singers, but, you know, out in the public, allowing women to be without hijab in the audience, dancing to the music. And so these concerts are pretty astounding. And I think it really speaks to the fact that music was so much part and parcel of these, has been of these protest movements, that allowing freedom over music is sort of giving a nod or giving an acknowledgement to the demands of Iranians.
Mm. So chants and protest songs have been a part of demonstrations for basically ever. I'm wondering in this case if the music came after or encompassed what people were saying, or if it helped drive the messages of the protest based on what these musicians were saying.
I think it really was the demands of the people, the musicians, picking those up and amplifying them and magnifying them and allowing for those to both unite people, but also push the boundaries on some of those demands and requests. And we see this in the way music was able to highlight the role of the minorities in Iran, whether they're ethnic minorities or women, which are part of the minority because of Iran's legal structures, the way in which, you know, Baluchi and Kurdish rappers had a role to play, or musicians had a role to play, the way in which, you know, this very intersectional international movement picked up on, you know, Chilean and anti-fascist protest song to point to this human endeavor, not just the Iranian, but to sort of place Iran within this larger continuum of human beings trying to achieve freedom and justice in the world. The music really elevated the demands of Iranians.
Based on how this protest music has been evolving over the past 3 years, what do you expect to see going forward?
There's so much going on, you know, in the region as well in terms of geopolitics. But if I were to look at the music, I think it's hard not to see a very bright future for Iran, right? Because you see the voices of people at large. You see the youth, but also, you know, older people, everybody uniting around these messages, hopeful messages for life, right? These are all messages signaling that Iranians want to live a good life. They want to live a free life. And they're all coming together to dance in the streets. I mean, this is such a joyous movement, too, despite all of the bloodshed. So it's very hard not to see a very bright future for Iran if these, you know, the people who've come around these movements and uprisings were to have a say or were to lead Iran into the future.
That hopeful note is a good place to end this conversation. Nahid Siamdous teaches Media and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's been telling us about the legacy of the protest music sparked by Iran's Woman Life Freedom Movement. Thank you so much for bringing us this music, Nahid.
Thank you so much for having me.
Liberty.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Tomorrow, singers from 23 countries, including the United States, will come together for the Intervision Song Contest, not to be confused with Eurovision. Intervision is hosted in Moscow. Organizers say it's all about bringing the world together on one stage to inspire and unite. But as The World's Joshua Koh found out, they also want to prove that despite its war in Ukraine, Russia still has friends.
Waiting for Waterloo by ABBA for Sweden. Watch this one.
Unless you live under a rock, you've probably heard Waterloo by ABBA.
My eyes at Waterloo.
That poppy ode to Napoleon's 1815 defeat won the Swedish group the 1974 Eurovision Song Contest and rocketed them to international stardom. But you'll be forgiven if you haven't heard Malovani Chibanku by Czech singer Helena von Rojkova. The song won top prize just a few years later at Intervision, the communist Eastern Bloc's answer to Eurovision. And if you haven't heard of Intervision, don't worry, Dean Vuletic has you covered.
I'm a historian of contemporary Europe and an expert on the history of the Eurovision and Intervision song contests.
Vuletic says the competition started back in the 60s in communist Czechoslovakia. The Czechoslovak broadcaster saw it as an economic and cultural bridge across Cold War divides.
It was modeled on the Eurovision Song Contest, but what Czechoslovak television wanted to do was to actually create a contest that would bring together artists from East and West, because Eurovision really only had artists from Western Europe.
Other countries did eventually join in. Finnish singer Marianne Rung won in 1980 with her hit song Hyvästi yö. Hyvästi yö, näen valon taivaan. Hyvästi yö. But Rung would be the last winner of an Intervision for a long, long time. The contest got canceled more than once over politics. The first time was in 1968, and that year the Czechoslovak government got canceled too. As Vuletic explains, Soviet tanks rumbled into the country to crush a democratic revolution known as the Prague Spring.
This movement was quashed in 1968, and that put an end to the liberalization currents in Czechoslovakia, which had also been expressed in Czechoslovak television and in the Intervision Song Contest.
The contest was revived in Poland in 1977, only to be canceled again in 1981, after the Polish government imposed martial law.
Intervision was not considered as an appropriate investment that should be continued because, you know, it had this political symbolism of being very open, of being inclusive also of Western artists, of global artists. So it was not something that the Polish government thought was appropriate to be continued after the imposition of martial law.
But fast forward to this week, and Intervision is back, this time in Russia.
Live from Moscow, Intervision, International Music Contest.
While the competition was never Russian, it seems to have one very influential Russian fan, the country's president, Vladimir Putin. And this week, he hyped up Intervision alongside other government-led cultural projects that he suggested were key to combating things like Russophobia, Nazism, and anti-Semitism.
I am convinced that the modern Intervision will fully preserve this atmosphere of creativity and friendship. It will be another confirmation that true art has no boundaries and its unifying forces are boundless. I wish all the contestants a successful performance.
Russia's Intervision is very international and features artists from all over the world. The host country's own heavyweight pop artist, Shaman, will compete with his song Straight to the Heart. Many of the countries represented are old friends of Russia, like Kazakhstan, Cuba, and Venezuela. Other countries like India, China, and South Africa have ties to Russia through BRICS, an international partnership seen as a counterweight to the U.S.-dominated G7 summits. Jess Carniel at the University of Southern Queensland in Australia studies the politics of song contests like Intervision. She says that since the war in Ukraine, Russia has been looking for ways to show the world that it still has friends and might be making some new ones.
So what we're seeing with Intervision now is something that's explicitly around international relations, explicitly around cultural diplomacy and the sharing of cultures that is being run by the Russian Ministry of Culture. So it is this overt reaching out for the purpose of showing friendships and connections.
For Carniel, one new connection in particular stands out at this modern Intervision: the United States.
According to the Intervision website, a less than well-known Greek-Australian pop singer who goes by the name Vassy will represent the country. Apparently, she's lived in the U.S. for over a decade and, as the website puts it, has had her music featured in the Oscar-winning Disney animated film Frozen and the TV series Grey's Anatomy. The contest website hasn't yet updated with her song entry, but here's her track Run to the Sun, as featured in an episode of Grey's Anatomy, Season 7, Episode 9, to be precise. In this clip that Vassy posted to her YouTube channel, the character Jackson Avery, a plastic surgeon and heartthrob, seems to be waking up from some sort of nightmare. I reached out to Vassy's management team for comment, but they did not respond in time for this report. Regardless of who represents the U.S. in the competition, the Australian scholar Carniel says Russia has a lot to gain from American participation in the event.
And it's incredibly useful for Russia to have the U.S. or a U.S. participant in this song contest because whether or not it is at an official level or not, it's showing, hey, look, the U.S. is willing to make a cultural connection.
I reached out to the U.S. Department of State asking about the degree of government involvement in the country's participation in the contest. The department declined to comment. Carniel explains that unlike Eurovision, it's not always clear who's sponsoring the contestants in Russia's Intervision revival. Some, she says, are backed by a government. Others are sponsored by companies. And a few might be there on their own, looking for their shot at international stardom. For the world, I'm Joshua Koh.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Enjoy the weekend. We'll catch you right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Cindy Ingalls, Dodie and Billy Crockett, and Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.